Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
For 30 years, Curtis DeBerg was a business professor at Chico State University. After he retired in 2020, he wrote Traveling the World with Hemingway, and now Curtis DeBerg has written a second book about Ernest Hemingway, Wrestling with Demons. Professor DeBerg writes, quote, "This book has allowed me to address, even exorcise, some of my own demons, as I refer to a famous larger-than-life man who is, in a very personal way, my kindred spirit." Curtis DeBerg, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Nancy.
So you say in this book that Hemingway is a kindred spirit. So that must have been part of the intrigue for you to write books about Hemingway.
Yes. You know, when I was in high school, I read Hemingway. I read The Old Man and the Sea, and I think I read maybe A Farewell to Arms. And I thought, oh, what a magnificent writer. And I never thought I'd, at this stage of my life and in my retirement years, write about Ernest Hemingway. But he suffered from several demons, and there's no author that's been written more about than Hemingway. And I decided to write a book after traveling to almost everywhere in the world he's been, and I almost seemed to live inside his head. And the demons are certainly his parents. He had a relationship with them that was pretty contentious. Wives.
In fact, a blurb on the cover of your book says, this book beautifully illustrates that all of us are shaped by our families, our struggles, and our demons, just as Hemingway was. And so you found that true in your case. When you learn about his life, oh my gosh, yes, we're shaped by our families, our struggles, and our demons. So one of the things that it's shocking, actually, to read about that happened to you, and you start right away with your book in your prologue, and you tell us. So would you read the opening paragraphs of your book?
Okay, I'd be happy to. The 15-minute flight in the ultra-lightweight plane was uneventful. As we eased in for the landing, the pilot and I had barely touched down. For only a second or two, when he pulled back on the controls, we took flight again. I thought he was showing off, doing an unannounced stop and go. I looked at him, and instead of a smile, I saw panic. He yelled, "Get your foot off the pedal!" Say what? I'd flown in the co-pilot's seat dozens of times throughout my life. My steadfast rule when landing has always been feet on floor, hands on lap. "Get your foot off the pedal," he repeated, his level of panic clearly escalating. I shouted back, "My feet are on the floor. My feet are on the floor." In the next few seconds, the plane, only a few yards above the ground, veered to the right, directly at two trees in front of a railroad embankment. The pilot pulled hard on his horizontal control bar and gunned the engine. Mercifully, we took flight, at least for a few seconds anyway. That's when the right wing clipped the top branch of the tallest tree. And as I was to learn later from the official investigation report, I also learned that the pilot was inebriated. The two-seater plane nosedived into the field, spinning like a corkscrew from a height around 50 to 100 meters. The last thing I remember before hitting the ground is saying to myself, "I'm dead."
This is Curtis DeBerg reading from his latest book, and the title of the book is Wrestling with Demons. It's supposedly in the subtitle, In Search of the Real Ernest Hemingway. As you write this book, sometimes the person, the narrator, the I, is not you. But in this case, this is you talking.
You know, I don't think I would have written any books about Hemingway if I couldn't relate to him personally. And Hemingway suffered from so much pain throughout his life. And most people know he had several concussions. He broke his arm really badly in the early 30s. He he had his own plane crash. He had two plane crashes in two consecutive days in 1954. And really, after my plane crash and after I survived it, I thought, who do I know that has survived a plane crash? And of course, Hemingway was the first person to come to mind.
Well, I'd like you to continue there because this, you tell us when this happened, this what you just told us about, this scene happened. When did it happen? Go ahead.
Yes, it happened in 2016. And from the book, almost 8 years ago, my universe changed. I was 59 years old. Up until then, I hadn't broken any bones except for two cracked ribs in a softball collision. At the time of the softball accident, I was a young man, only 23, straight out of college, and working for a national accounting firm as a certified public accountant. My luck ran out, though, when the airplane crashed. I fractured my left wrist with both the radius and the ulna cleanly broken. The left side of my pelvis was crushed, and worst of all, the left tibia, the bone connecting the knee and the ankle, was severely broken in two places. My body was so contorted by the dashboard and instruments in the crash that I couldn't see my leg. The pilot's son-in-law, Peter, was first on the scene, arriving within minutes of the crash. Afterward, in the hospital, he said, "Kurt, it's a good thing you didn't see your leg. The bone was sticking out through your blue jeans."
This is Curtis DeBerg reading from his newest book, and he's describing what happened to him. And you describe how badly your body was damaged. But then you go on to say, well, you know, getting wounded can be beneficial to a writer. You refer to the wound theory in your book. And so what in the world is the wound theory?
Yes. In 1918, when Hemingway was almost 19 years old, he was an ambulance driver for the American Red Cross in Italy. And the first few weeks over in Italy, he hadn't seen any action. In fact, he and his fellow ambulance drivers were bored. And so he volunteered to go to the Piave River near a city called Fasalta, where the action was happening. And so he volunteered to become a canteen worker rather than an ambulance driver. And on the night of July 8, without permission, he went to the front line, without permission from the American Red Cross. But he was in good standing with the Italian officer in charge of the skirmish that night. And the Italian officer allowed Hemingway into the front line trench, where when he was distributing...
The question was about the wound theory. So he suffered a wound.
Yes.
So how did that relate to him as a writer? Because he was just an 18-year-old then. He was not a writer then.
He was looking for action, and he knew that the best way to describe scenes in a war was to experience it. And one cannot experience the war and be able to write about it without actually seeing death and, in his case, being wounded. And he was wounded by a mortar bomb where...
Well, I wanted to go back to what he said then, because he was he knew F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yes.
And so he once offered this advice to Scott Fitzgerald, and he says, how can you bleed over your own tragedies when you're a writer? You should welcome them, because serious writers have to be hurt really terribly before they can write seriously. And then he went on to say, but once you get the hurt and can handle it, consider yourself lucky. That's what there is to write about. And you have to be as faithful to it as a scientist is faithful to his laboratory. You can't cheat or pretend. You have to excise the hurt honestly. So here's Hemingway, your kindred spirit.
Yes.
Writing to a fellow writer saying, well, be happy. If you've got a wound, then this is something you can write about. So I would like you to pick up your story then about your plane crash.
Okay. My own plane crash left me with extensive bone and nerve damage. Certainly not good for writers. I considered myself lucky. I felt the urge to become a writer, and no, I couldn't bleed over my own personal tragedy. I now knew real pain. It bedeviled me as it bedeviled Hemingway. I didn't know the extent of Hemingway's demons, nor did I know what really drove him to become a great writer. In this, Hemingway was right and Philip Young was wrong. It wasn't his physical or psychological wounds from World War I, and no, it wasn't post-traumatic stress syndrome either. As I trekked in Hemingway's homes, or to Hemingway's homes, his vacation spots, and war zones, I came to discover that Hemingway was right to challenge the wound theory as one of the main influences shaping his career and personal life. Other factors were more important, one of which was fear. He was deathly afraid that if people learned the truth of what really happened to him in World War I, they would regard him as a faker, a liar, or a fool. Beyond any doubt, he wasn't a hero. On the contrary, he may well have caused the death of an Italian soldier. Instead of a medal for valor, he likely deserved a one-way trip home to Oak Park, Illinois. Living with such a big lie would have weighed heavily on any man, and is one of the main reasons, quote, that his inner landscape was a nightmare, and he spent his nights wrestling with the gods, unquote, as Norman Mailer said after Hemingway's suicide.
This is Chico author Curtis DeBerg, and he is reading from his book, Wrestling with Demons. And I just suppose that this is not the book you thought you were going to write. So can we kind of fast forward to July of 2019?
Okay. Actually, are you talking about July of 2016?
Well, 2019 is when I was asking you, was this the book you thought you were going to write?
Right. I was a full-time business professor at Chico State in the fall of 2019 when I was granted a one-year sabbatical. And my plan was to learn more about teaching technology to accounting students. But when I decided to go to Paris, I spent a lot of my spare time investigating the places Hemingway traveled back in the early 20s, the places he wrote, the people he met. And then I decided I'm going to write a book about traveling the world in Hemingway's footsteps. But the more I read and the more I learned, I discovered there's a story about Hemingway that hasn't been told. And that's the story about the lies he told in World War I. And it wasn't the wound theory that drove him to be a great writer. What drove him to be a great writer was his unbelievable imagination and his hypomanic personality. And what do I mean by hypomanic? Hypomania is a condition it's not quite bipolar, but it's a condition where he can still interact with other people, but he has extreme mood swings. And when I learned more about Hemingway, I knew that it wasn't his wounds that drove him to greatness. It was the fear that the big lies that he told about his wounding would be discovered.
My guest is former professor Curtis DeBerg, and his newest book is Wrestling with Demons. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Weekman. I'm Nancy Weekman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And my guest today is former professor Curtis DeBerg, who has studied the life of Ernest Hemingway, and his newest book is Wrestling with Demons. Well, this guy, Ernest Hemingway. There has been so much written about him. Ken Burns did a documentary for PBS and this was fairly recent. I mean, Hemingway was a 20th century writer, and here we are seeing on PBS information about Hemingway in just a couple of years ago. So what more can you say about Ernest Hemingway? What do you offer that is new?
Oh, that's a great question. I have been to Hemingway's wounding site twice in Fasalta, Italy, and I've interviewed two historians in Fasalta. These are Italians. And I learned that, A, Hemingway was in the trenches that evening on July 8 against Red Cross orders. But I also learned that by creating the commotion that he did, because the Italians were only about 50 yards across the river from the enemy, the Austrians, and by causing such a commotion, the Austrians were able to pinpoint exactly where the soldiers were, and they trained their mortar bomb into that area. So what I discovered that was new is Hemingway was no hero. In fact, a man came between Hemingway and the exploding mortar blast, and he died.
Well, now, you were saying you discovered something new. This was news to you, but didn't other people know this?
It wasn't until the year 2019 that a historian named Marino Perissinotto discovered that the man who died next to Hemingway was a man named Fedele Temperini. And no one in the Hemingway world credits Temperini with saving Hemingway's life. Now, there were no witnesses there, but the reports that we know is that, for a fact, there was a man who shielded Hemingway from the blast, possibly saving his life, or for certain saving him from much greater injury. And so Hemingway was not a hero. He may have caused the death of an Italian soldier.
Well, it's interesting how brief he was when Ernest Hemingway wanted to wire his parents, and he said, "Wounded in legs by trench mortar, not serious, will receive Valor Medal, will walk in about 10 days. And so that's what he told his parents. He just said he was wounded and he was going to get a medal.
He was only going to be 19 years old. Actually, on July 8th, the date of his wounding, was 2 weeks shy. So remember, Hemingway was just a kid then, and he lusted for a medal. He wanted to be able to go home to Oak Park and tell his parents that he saw action. And he wasn't wounded as badly as he later made out to be.
In fact, I'd like you to read a little section from your book about this.
Yes. Ernest and I both knew the short story wasn't the real story. The real medal winner should have been the Italian soldier who died in the frontline trench with Ernest that moonless night. He deserved the silver. No one knows for sure if the soldier intentionally put himself between Ernest and the exploding bomb. If he did, he deserved the gold medal. I don't think Ernest really believed that the only heroes are those who died. Ernest didn't die, but he sure wanted to be a hero. To confirm his heroism, he needed the silver medal.
Now, this section I just ask you to read starts out with Ernest and I. And when you say Ernest and I, now you're the writer. In this section that you just read, that's not you. So in the first thing I ask you to read, I was in this plane crash, that is you, the writer.
Yes.
But now when you were just talking about what really happened,
yes,
that was not you. So how did you set up this book? So your prologue, the narrator is you, the author.
Yes.
And in chapter one, it was the smell of all the things I remembered about that. And this is, who is that?
The narrator of chapter one, I start out by creating a scene of the first person who met Hemingway after his wounding, the first American, and that American was Captain James Gamble. And Captain Gamble was 36, 37 years old. He was almost twice as old as Ernest, but he was the first one who came to understand what really happened in the trenches.
So we have two different narrators. So the prologue that I ask you to read, you could consider, well, that's a memoir.
Yes.
This is the author talking. He's recounting a memory. So that's a memoir. This is, how would you categorize this genre in chapter one?
Yes, by creating a scene that no one paid witness to and no one could actually hear the dialogue, a writer, an author, can create a genre known as historical fiction. And historical fiction is based on historical fact, but the fiction part is that part which no one can ever, it wasn't documented in any official reports. So the big thing that makes my book different than from almost every other biography is I use three genres. I take my memoir and I say, look, I can relate to Hemingway's pain now, and I can relate to Hemingway's relationship with his parents and his relationship with friends. I can now personally better relate. That's the memoir part of the book, Nancy. The biography part, I never intended to write a biography. But the more I dug into Hemingway's life, the more questions I had to ask, and I tried to find answers for. Those questions that I couldn't answer because there's no historical reports, there's no historical witnesses, I was able to recreate this by creating dialogue that no one could know for sure. And this dialogue between Hemingway and the first man who came upon Hemingway's wounding, where Hemingway had no reason to embellish. And he confesses to Captain Gamble that, yeah, he was in the frontline trench, and yes, he was there without permission. But gosh, now he can get a medal. He was wounded. He can show people that he's got these wounds in his leg.
Well, so would you read us the words? You have put these words in this guy's mouth. So
yes.
Would you read us his words as you expect they would have taken place?
Exactly. This is the beginning of chapter one, and Captain Jim Gamble is saying this. It was the smell. Of all the things I remembered about that interminable, suffocating journey, it was the smell. The offensive odor wasn't so bad when we first started out on that slow hospital train from Mestre, early on the morning of July 12, 1918. But by noon, the stench got to me. I made my own contribution and puked into a bucket. Among the wounded lying on their cots was 18-year-old Ernest Hemingway. I sat on a wobbly wooden chair next to Ernest. Flies were everywhere. I kept shooing them off his hands and feet. His right leg was bandaged from toes to thigh. Occasionally, when the train rounded a curve or slowed to let some sheep or cattle pass, the catheters came undone and half-filled bedpans sloshed over onto the floor. The Italian nurses tried their best to clean up the malodorous deposits. The smell and the flies didn't seem to bother Ernest, though. In spite of his injuries, mostly minor wounds to his right leg, he seemed happy. The morphine helped. For me, the alcohol I'd bought in Mestre took the edge off, but it didn't help dull the smell.
You know, as you're reading this, by the way, this is Curtis DeBerg reading from his book, Wrestling with Demons. It's about Ernest Hemingway, and these were the words of this guy who witnessed what happened to Ernest Hemingway, as you imagine their actual, what he would actually say. And as I hear you reading this, I think, you know, I know now why you know about smell and catheters, and I want to give you a chance to tell about that, what happened after your plane crash, because as you're reading that, I thought, oh, that's how he knows personally about catheters and smells. Well, so the real story is what you were just telling us. What really happened. Would you continue that section in the words of this historical figure?
Right. My name is Gamble, Captain James Gandle. Gamble, Field Inspector of the American Red Cross's Rolling Canteen Service. I was Ernest's commanding officer when he was assigned to take over canteen number 14. I liked him at once, despite his swashbuckling manner. He called me Chief, or Capitano. At 36 years old, I was double his age. We developed an unusually close relationship from the get-go, as if I were his big brother. We had much in common despite his lack of worldly experiences. Both of us loved the arts. For me, it was painting. For him, literature. I liked to play polo. He enjoyed boxing. We talked often about the women we fancied and admired. We both enjoyed sparkling wine and cognac. When the war was over, we both wanted to explore the world. He wanted to take me fishing on the Fox River in the eastern part of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. And I wanted to show him Taormina, my favorite city in Sicily. He was adventurous, the kind of fellow who'd be fun to travel with.
This is Curtis DeBerg. He is formerly a professor at Chico State University, and he took a trip to all the places that Ernest Hemingway had been to and wrote a book called Traveling the World with Hemingway. But now his recent book is Wrestling with Demons, and you even list at one point what Hemingway's demons were. What were Hemingway's demons?
I identified four that have been extensively written about and a fifth one that hasn't been extensively written about. Ernest had a contentious relationship with both parents, especially his mother. And in my book, I have a chapter devoted to my mother as well, because Ernest's relationship with Grace was not all that unlike my relationship with my mother. And chapter six, I believe it is called Ruby. So I could relate to Ernest's relationship with his mom, and he being from Illinois, me being from Iowa, we were both Midwesterners, so we had that in common. He was married four times, and he had a hard time committing to any one woman, and that's the demon that I could relate the least to, but I could relate a little bit because I've been married once, and I've had, like everyone, I've had a few relationships, and I could relate to Ernest's demons there. But Ernest had a problem with alcohol. Do I have a problem with alcohol? I'll let my friends tell you about that, but I do enjoy a pale ale at Sierra Nevada on occasion. The fourth demon was depression. Ernest suffered from depression his entire life, and I could relate to that a little bit. But the fifth demon that is I've identified is his competitiveness with other people, especially writers, and also two people that died in World War I. One of them, of course, was the Italian soldier who protected Hemingway from the blast. And it's funny that Hemingway never, ever mentioned this real hero in any of his writing, his personal letters or in his literature. The other man who died was a man named Captain Edward McKee, who was a Red Cross ambulance driver turned canteen worker. He died exactly 2 weeks before, actually 3 weeks before Hemingway was wounded. He died only 2 miles from the same site that Hemingway was wounded. And Hemingway never really mentioned McKee in any of his literature except in one brief poem where he talks about the Grim Reaper coming to settle the score with this man who's having these awful nightmares. And so I devote a little time to Hemingway's demon, because if this man intentionally saved Hemingway's life by putting his body between himself and the exploding bomb, then the writers, the biographers have it wrong. It wasn't his wounding that drove him to great writing. It was his guilty conscience.
Well, because the word demons is in the title of your book, Wrestling with Demons, I just want to go back over the five demons that you identified. You said the first four are his parents, remorse, physical pain, and anguish. And the fifth is, you label it, rivalry.
Yes.
Jeez. So Hemingway had these demons that he dealt with, and you said you share some, not all of these demons.
Yeah.
And you say, everywhere I go now, it seems Hemingway is with me. He is my own movable feast. I tend to think of his novels like my favorite. Your favorite novel of his is?
Well, For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Yeah, that's what you say, that For Whom the Bell Tolls is your favorite one. And that you say Hemingway is with you wherever you go. Now, related to your book in a totally different way because I didn't have these experiences that you did. But some of the places you went, and he was in Paris or where you live now in the Basque Country. And, oh, I just – there was a, there's a small town in Spain, Burguete,
yeah.
And my husband and I happened to be traveling through there, and they said, oh, Hemingway stayed here. And so when I mentioned that, people said, oh, did you stay in the same room that Hemingway stayed in? Well, I don't know. Maybe they did put us in the same room as Hemingway. But that's why I – one of the reasons I enjoyed your book, because those were pleasant memories. Now, what was not so pleasant is what happened to you. Now, I ask you to tell us about your plane crash, but that was only the beginning of this awful journey. So I'm going to go ahead now to what you experienced after this plane crash.
Right. Well, this plane crash took place 8 years ago in at the end of June of 2016, and I was on holiday, and I was expecting to come back to Chico State to do a summer program with several West African students who were coming to the U.S., and I was so much looking forward to this, but I was visiting Poland, and one of my friend's father asked me to go flying with him. I did go flying, and of course, you heard the passage about me getting hurt, but that was only the beginning. I spent a month in a Polish hospital. The food was awful. The nursing was awful.
Forgive me for chuckling, because I mentioned that some of these things in your book, I didn't get wounded myself, but a friend did. We spent time in a European hospital. And in France, the French are so proud of their cuisine that I had higher expectations of the food in a French hospital. You're shaking your head. And
no.
And so the person that was in the hospital close to me, he said, would you bring me a salad? So on the way visiting hours, I would pick up a salad at the supermarket. So there you are in this hospital in Poland.
Yes, yes. And I really needed and wanted to be home near my loved ones after, you know, suffering this near-death experience. So my brother from Minneapolis helped, through the U.S. Embassy in Poland, arrange for me to fly home on a Turkish Airlines flight. And accompanying me were a nurse and a doctor.
You know, before your brother comes over, before you're going to get out of the hospital, I found that the quality, the technology in France, French hospitals had the latest in technology. Now, their food, not so much. But the technology was equal, if not superior, to what we have here in U.S. hospitals. And your experience, I read in your book, was?
The surgeons in Poland were amazingly adept at surgeries. And they performed surgeries on my hand, my leg, my pelvis. And when the doctors here in the U.S. were able to see what they had done, they had remarked at how incredibly well done the surgeons were. And the joke they made is they have a lot of practice at surgeries because they've been in the center of so many wars in Europe. Now, yes, I was in the hospital for a month there, and you asked me a little bit earlier about my journey home.
One thing, I was caregiver for this person who had metal installed. It happened to be in his arm that they put metal in him. And so I'm assuming that with all these broken bones that you had, you're a walking reservoir of metal. Yeah, you're pointing to scars on your arm, but your arm looks fine.
You know, you can barely see
See the scars.
But my hand was actually lying flat against my forearm, and I could see the bone. I was in shock, I'm sure, from the injury to my leg, or to my hand, and I couldn't feel my leg because of the nerve damage. But what was killing me was my pelvis. There were several fire trucks surrounding the plane because of there was a fuel leakage. They were fearing a fire. And so I'm not sure, Nancy, I'm recounting the story, and you got two parts, the injury itself, and all my friends wanted to know if I was knocked out, and I wasn't. I was conscious. Nobody ever asked Hemingway if he was knocked out, but he let people assume he was knocked out because he said the concussion from the explosion left him dizzy.
Professor DeBerg and I will be back after a short break. We're talking about his latest book, Wrestling with Demons, In Search of the Real Ernest Hemingway. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. This is Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. And I'm here with my guest, Curtis DeBerg, whose latest book is Wrestling with Demons, In Search of the Real Ernest Hemingway. Now, you were in a plane crash, just like this kindred spirit of yours.
Yes.
Were in two plane crashes. Hemingway was in two plane crashes. But you're, how old were you at the time?
59. Yes.
And 59 is pretty young.
Yes.
In my book. And up until then, you said you hadn't broken any bones in your whole life, but your luck ran out.
You know, I found my own pain, and I think that's when I decided I wanted to become a writer. And, you know,
the wound theory.
Yes. I knew pain, but Hemingway also said that nerve damage or broken bones are good for nobody, including writers. So Hemingway
said, he did make that exception.
Yeah. He said, look, I know pain, and the more times I get hurt, the more fodder I have to write my short stories. Now, Hemingway almost sought pain, you know. He shot himself in the leg on his boat, the Pilar, when he was going deep sea fishing. He had several self-inflicted accidents, but the more he experienced, the better he wrote. But he certainly wouldn't have wished himself nerve damage that would cause him to have pain, extreme pain, for the rest of his life.
And that's what you say in your book. Well, you say no one plans on a personal tragedy. It just happens. I didn't plan to spend the rest of my life with pain. And I surely didn't plan to author a book about Hemingway. But you say spend the rest of your life with pain. So right now, as we're sitting here talking, you must have help with managing the pain, though. Are you in pain right now, may
yes,
I ask?
Yes, I am. Yes. On a what level of a 1 to 10?
Yes.
I'd say between a 6 and a 7.
Oh, my goodness.
Even
with pain meds?
I fell and broke my hip with my bad leg a couple years after the accident. And the nurses asked me what my pain level was. And I asked, my pain level in my hip or the pain level that I have daily? And she said, well, you're here because of your hip. What's your pain level? And I said, well, I suppose it's an 8, but it's not much greater than what I have every day. And so I'm taking pregabalin, which we would call it Lyrica here. It's a medication that abates the pain just enough to help me smile.
Oh, my goodness.
But it hurts like hell, yeah.
Well, so they perform this surgery, and then they're going to kind of rebuild. They're taking muscle from one part of your body and skin from a part of your body, and they're going to put it where it should, where it can do you some good. And then, you know, earlier when your character was talking about the smell,
yeah,
it was a totally different smell than what you experienced. I thought, oh, my goodness, what was...
The worst day of my life was the day I had my plane crash because of the extreme pain. But the second worst incident in my life happened during the same period on my flight home. I was accompanied by a doctor and a nurse, and because of the nerve pain and my lying flat on my back, they had removed the catheter, and they didn't know that I wasn't able to urinate without a catheter.
Well, before you're on your flight home, yes. I know that was painful, but before that, they actually did some transplanting of muscle and skin, which is...
Yes, that happened in the U.S.
Oh.
When I got home from this arduous 30-hour flight and ambulance ride from... First, it was from Poznan, Poland to Berlin, Berlin to Istanbul, Istanbul to San Francisco.
And they thought there was going to be a delay.
There were delays. They were going to turn back because of traffic over the Atlantic Ocean. That we were delayed. But in any case, I'll keep this very short. My doctor and nurse had failed to pack a urinary catheter. And in Istanbul, they were forced to use a chest catheter to help me, to help relieve myself.
Your bladder, because your bladder, you said it felt like a water balloon.
It did, and the catheter was 2.5 times the size of a urinary catheter, and it was inserted without anesthesia.
Well, they gave you a towel to bite on.
They gave me a towel, and they said, don't be afraid to cry. And I cried.
Well, this is why I refer to the fact that when you were reading that section about catheters, that you unfortunately had firsthand experience with catheters. So, back to your on this plane, trying to get back. The plane has various stops, and this was a special plane.
Yes, it was made in, I think it was a Czechoslovakian plane. It was a lightweight aircraft that could only fit two people. In fact, the pilot could pick up the tail with one arm. And as I read in the introduction, unbeknownst to me, he had drank quite a bit of wine before we had taken
flight. The pilot of the plane that you crashed in.
Yes.
Yes.
And, of
yes.
course, the litigation followed, and it's 8 years later, and it's still being litigated. And that's a subject for another story.
And he claimed, well, yeah, the alcohol content in my blood was high, but that's a false reading because I ate a bunch of cherries and I ate some sauerkraut. I thought, good grief, this guy is, well...
Oh, you know, I gave him a moniker in the book that was not flattering, and I don't think you would want me to repeat that.
No, I don't think so. But this guy who took you up in his plane, he was bragging about how much
land he owned.
Yeah,
yes.
And he was well off, and he's flying this plane after drinking. So that's why he tried to say, oh, no, I wasn't the pilot. This guy named Curtis DeBerg in the man plane, it's his fault because he had his feet on the controls. And
well, unbeknownst to me, 6 years before this, he crashed a plane, and he likely had been drinking, but they couldn't prove it because he had put the plane into a lake, and he didn't report it until 48 hours later, and ostensibly he needed this time probably to sober up.
So when they tested his blood for alcohol content, enough time had passed that it was okay. And this time, though, he said, oh, well, it's just because of what I ate. My blood alcohol is not really that high.
Plus, he needed to pin the blame on me by saying my feet were on the foot pedals, right? So that he could, this would give him an alibi for being a good pilot and that he was not at fault. Needless to say, I wish that my friend had let me know that her father had a drinking problem.
Oh, yeah. Because you didn't know that when you got in the plane with this guy.
No.
We mentioned the fact that you have a special plane arranged. Now, who was it that arranged for your flight back to the United States from Poland?
Yes. My brother had contacted this company in Warsaw, and they had just started flying passengers overseas that were wounded. They do war victims. They do civilians. And in my case, they developed this special stretcher that was flexible enough to carry me into the plane. And they lifted me above four seats. And I was taking up four chairs. And of course, I was having my problems with my bladder. And I was on a commercial flight. And we were 3 hours into the flight when I could actually feel the plane begin to turn around. And the pilot came on and said, we may need to go back to Istanbul because we are being told by the folks over the Atlantic that we can't go because of traffic. And I'm thinking, what if I have to go to an Istanbul hospital with a nurse and a doctor who speak Polish? And they have no record of me and my accident. What am I going to do? I mean, my stepmother and my brother were watching my flight on their computer screen, and they thought maybe this plane is being kidnapped. They saw the plane actually do a U-turn briefly, but then they were told they could carry on. We landed, I think it was in St. Louis or Kansas City, to refuel. And by the time I got to the Chico Hospital, 36 hours later, The first person to greet me, other than in my hospital, said, "Dr. DeBrugh, it's good to see you." And I said, "How do you know me?" And he said, "I was a student of yours in your accounting class 10 years ago, but I changed to nursing."
Yeah, I love that little bit. Just those few sentences in your book. How sweet was that?
I'm going, gosh, it's good to be home.
Oh, I'll say.
Yeah.
My guest is former professor Curtis DeBrugh. He was a professor at Chico State University, and he was fascinated with Ernest Hemingway, and he went in search of the real Ernest Hemingway. The title of his recent book is Wrestling with Demons. Now, they put metal in your arm,
yes.
But in your leg, they couldn't put enough metal to hold up your leg. So what was the solution then for your left leg?
Right. Well, that's almost right. When I got back to the U.S., the surgeons needed to fill in the gap. I had a gaping wound in my left calf muscle. And so they took some muscle from my lower calf, and the plastic surgeon inserted it into my leg, but that became infected with E. coli. And another infection is called enterococcus. So there were two different infections, and now the fight was on to save my leg. And the only way they could save my leg was to remove the steel and put in what they call an ex-fixator cage. So I'm now walking.
And you have a photograph, by the way, of your leg, yes, in this ex-fixator.
Mm-hmm. And so I have no steel in my leg anymore, but the ex-fixator made it so that I can walk. I can walk now without a brace, but I have
you don't have a cane or anything. You're just walking normally.
I have drop foot, which means I need to be careful when I walk because I tend not to pick up my left foot because of the nerve pain. But I'm walking without a cane, I'm very happy. In spite of the pain, I have the fortitude to say, ignore it. I don't need it. I'm going to live a happy life. I now live in Andailles, France, with my beautiful French girlfriend. And that's how my story ends for now. I'm living in France.
Yeah, and that's beautiful. We haven't even gotten to all the things that you have in your book about Ernest Hemingway and his wives. You mentioned his parents because a lot of times that motivates people to want to please their parents. You mentioned all his different wives.
Yes.
And one thing that was helpful because you start— which wife was that, and was she older or younger, or what were her talents, and why did he want to marry her? And you help us, the reader, because you have charts. I studied your charts. Oh, here was wife number one, and here was how he met her, and how old she was. So thank you for doing that.
He had four wives, and of course, maybe it was the business faculty member coming out of me. I included a couple tables with a taxonomy of not only their biography, but also of their personality traits. And one thing that makes my book, again, a little different is I give wife number two, Pauline, more credit than anybody else because Pauline was most compatible with Ernest. Pauline came from a very wealthy background, and Ernest came from an upper middle class background. She was kind of a socialite and somewhat of a snob. Ernest liked running with people who had who were famous. Ernest liked fancy
Gertrude Stein, Scott Fitzgerald.
He loved hanging with Gerald and Sarah Murphy on the French Riviera. He befriended Picasso. Hemingway loved being around other people who were artists and wealthy. And
Even mention in your chapter on Pauline, you say most biographers paint Hadley Richardson as his best wife. That was his first wife, as his best wife. Their conclusions are mostly based, it seems, on Ernest's description of their marriage in his memoirs, A Movable Feast. And you're saying, hey, give Pauline some credit.
You know, what Mary Hemingway, Ernest's widow, fourth wife, she edited A Movable Feast posthumously after Ernest died in 1961. And she made Hadley the heroine of the story. And she ended the book with this beautiful passage about Hemingway saying he wished he'd never married anyone else, that his true love was Hadley. But he fell head over heels with all of his wives. And
sometimes he wished he could be married to two women at once.
He said he wished he could be married to 10 women, you know. And Pauline Ernest had a special spot in his heart for Pauline because she was the mother of two of his sons. And even though Pauline was not a really good mother, Ernest fell in love with her, and he truly loved her. He was married to her for the longest time. He lived with her in Key West. And what happened in a second book, A Movable Feast, was put out by Sean Hemingway, who was related to Pauline. And he said, look, Ernest intended to write another Paris book about his second half of Paris when he lived with Pauline. So what most people don't know is Hemingway planned to write another book called A Movable Feast 2, perhaps. That wouldn't have been his title, but Pauline deserved much more credit than she got.
Now, we don't have time to go into some of the other this other genre. We mentioned that your book, some chapters are memoir, your life.
Yeah.
Some are biography. And then there's a third, because you say in your book that you refer to two Hemingways in this book. One you call Ernest, that's the one we know, and then you create this ghost. And some of the chapters, you talk to his ghost. But now, I'm going to have to leave that to readers, because there's so much in here that we, I mean, it's, what, nearly
450 pages.
450 pages, yes. And there's so much interesting information I found in this book that I think people will want to pick up a copy of.
I hope so.
Thank you, Kim, for coming in. Oh, merci, monsieur.
Oh, de rien, madame.
Again, the title of the book is Wrestling with Demons in Search of the Real Ernest Hemingway. The author is Curtis DeBerg. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
She breathes only trees. The alders taste like creek water and relish the shade. The white firs seek sun with their upswept branches and pointed needle crowns. She understands their roots, the way they spread and wrap through hard clay soil. She once was a tree. They cut her down. The bleeding sap of her heart would, sticky and sweet. She knows the voice beneath the voice of poplars, how they loosen their leaves on the breeze. She inhales cedar, exhales oak, its solid heaviness that twists and reaches for the sun. She kisses the smooth bark of madrones and runs her fingers along the feathery surface of redwoods. She knows the shapes of all the leaves, the glisten of needles, and that they bend and curtsy in the wind. She knows the silence of rain on their branches when all the leaves have been shed. Jean Varda.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.